I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 144 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. Our guest this week fronted an acclaimed gritty Boston band in the 80s, but found even greater success when he switched to making what he calls family music, Dan Zanes. Zane sang, played guitar, and wrote songs for the Del Fuegos, one of Slash Records' stellar stable of bands in the mid-1980s. Their debut, The Longest Day, came out in 1984, and the following year's follow-up, Boston Mass, propelled the band onto radio and MTV with the singles Don't Run Wild and I Still Want You. Around the same time, Del Fuegos were featured in a Miller beer commercial that spurred heated debate on whether the band had sold out. Those were different times.
Rock and roll's folk music, pretty much. But, you know, it's because it's for folks.
Zanes explains here what the band was thinking and how much the backlash affected their trajectory. Zane's 1995 solo album, Cool Down Time, is his one album that has only his name on it. He likes playing with others. The 2000 family music album Rocket Ship Beach marked the debut of Dan Zanes and friends. Zanes has quite a story about how it came to be and how performers such as Sheryl Crow, Wally, Wally, Doodle, Suzanne Vega,
bridge, cause we're coming to a town, and you'll always know your neighbor, you'll always know your pal if you've ever navigated on the Erie Canal.
And Simon Kirk of Bad Company wound up appearing on it.
Won't you come on over and meet my friends? Oh, I wish you would, cause all my friends live in the woods.
That album launched the second, longer, more far-reaching phase of Zanes' career. There have been 15 Dan Zanes and Friends family albums, and you could sing and dance along to all of them, as my kids and their parents did. In 2021, Dan and his wife, jazz singer Claudia Zanes, released the album Let Love Be Your Guide.
Someday we could all be free.
Now they have a new album, Pieces of Home, which comes out August 30th on the Smithsonian Folkways label. The first single, Fly Like a Raven, is out already, and you'll want to dance to that one too.
Well, there's a brand new dance that's going around.
In this freewheeling, open-hearted conversation, Dan Zanes takes us from his youth in New Hampshire to his current life in the Baltimore area with Claudia. What influence did his mother have on him and his younger brother, Warren Zanes? How did Warren wind up in the Del Fuegos? How did being a Boston band shape them? How did Dan Zanes free himself from his self-destructive tendencies? Does he make a distinction between family music and folk music? Is it mandatory to be able to dance to his music? How important is the intergenerational aspect of family music? How are he and Claudia pursuing sensory-friendly performances? Does he ever still write the occasional kick-ass rock song? What does he see as his higher purpose? Claudia Zanes also comes on toward the end to tell her part of the story in a completely harmonious way. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Dan Zanes.
It's a story.
I've enjoyed Pieces of Home. It's really cool. It comes out August 30th. Sounds great. I have to say also that, you know, you had albums that, you know, I have two girls. My younger daughter just turned 20, but, you know, like Rocket Ship Beach and Family Dance were in heavy rotation when they were growing up. And I've just been thinking about how, you know, you have all these albums, Dan Zane and Friends. I think there's one Dan Zanes record that doesn't have an and or an ampersand after it. Is singing with someone else just what you like to do?
It has been since I started playing music for kids and families. Absolutely. Because for a couple reasons, one is it just gets more interesting, and doing family music it's just wide open, man. You know, when I was doing pop music, or, you know, the Del Fuegos, we had our band, and that we did what we did. But with family music, I can do whatever I want, you know, from song to song. But I also want listeners, especially kids, you know, especially young people, to hear the sound of the neighborhood, you know, to hear people coming together, and to hear, you know, to hear a communal sound. I think that's the inspiring thing. So if you can hear a variety of voices and it sounds like you're walking down the street, you know, that's the message behind that, I think, is
right.
A great one.
message aside, do you as a singer like singing with other people?
I like singing with other people that have a, you know, a particular kind of a spirit. And I feel like the thing that I've been, you know, way beyond any kind of talent I might have in music, which I think is, you know, moderate at best, is my strongest thing is my ability to see something in other people that they may or may not see in themselves. And I feel like I've shown that throughout my whole family music career, is just, you know, finding people with this unbelievable spirit that have, you know, a lot of them grew into the Dan Zanes and Friends, you know, scene, and sort of found something incredible that they did within that loose collective that we had, you know, people like Father Goose or Eleanor right. Moon Park or Sonia De Los Santos. And I mean, Claudia has always been great, but I mean, to, you know, singing with Claudia now is, you know, it's just unbelievable. She's, you know, the person I've been dreaming about my whole life, you know, that we could be, you know, best friends and we could be in a relationship and we make music. I mean, come on, man. That's
right.
It doesn't get better than that.
And it turns out she has a great voice too. And you guys sound incredible. Really good together. So, you know,
she's so good.
You could have fallen in love with someone who sounded like, you know, olive oil from Popeye or something. And then, you know, it just would be a different experience.
Totally.
But yeah, no, it's, what was it on, Open Windows from Let Love Be Your Guide from 2021, an album you did with Claudia. You know, I think that's one where you have all these kids just kind of coming in and saying what they love about, you know, their families hugging them or, you know, whatever. And it is this just very generous, open-hearted experience listening to something like that.
When I was playing rock and roll and I just thought, you know, thought I was such a badass and this and that, I look back at the photos and, you know, we're not smiling. We're kind of like just staring at the camera, you know, we're so tough, you know, and to be, you know, to move past that and to be making this family music, you know, we live in a hard edge world, man, you know, and I think that for young people to be able to access something that's got some emotional core to it and it's fun and, you know, a lot of times you can dance to it, you know, I think that emotional core, I put a lot more value on that and I don't feel funny about it. I feel blessed that I have the capacity to do that now and, you know, sort of found a place where I can do it. And you know, and Claudia is a music therapist, and so as if I didn't know before, you know, just learning more about music therapy and how music works for all of us. There's just so much, you know, so much to be said for delivering the goods in a kind of a positive way. You know, it's just,
right.
it helps.
Now music being the vessel to bring people together, which, you know, that's why sing-alongs work, because
yeah,
people
man.
Sing along, you know? So Pieces of Home, your new album with Claudia, I mean, would you put that in the category of family music then?
Yeah, for sure. And I think, I mean, to me, they're all family music because it's all pretty G-rated stuff. And it's, I think when I think of family music, I think of songs that anyone can listen to, but it may lean more towards the older folks or it may lean more towards the younger folks, but it never leaves anybody behind. But we're not doing what I would call children's music, in, you know, the music that's particular to the experiences of children, you know, maybe whether it's, you know, learning to eat with a fork or putting on a pair of pants or, you know, getting on a school bus. There's a lot of stuff that is very particular. And that's not what there's so many people doing a great version of children's music, but we're trying to do the kind of stuff that I heard as a kid, which was, you know, Lead Belly believed that he to me was sort of the architect of modern family music, you know, that the songs that would be a window to the world outside, the young people could, songs that young people could carry with them through life, you know. So that's kind of what we're working more off of that model.
Is there a distinction between family music and folk music?
For me, folk music is such a wide, you know, it's such a big bag. And I don't know exactly the answer to that, but one thing I do know is that in the folk singers that I grew up listening to, the Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, Lead Belly, they all believed that part of their job description was to have a whole lot of songs in their heads that they could pull out when they were in front of young people. You know, so it was part of the folk singer's job to be able to entertain young people, which meant songs that you could teach so they could sing along, and songs that they could carry on with them to wherever they go, and songs that would sort of galvanize them and help them think differently about something, you know. So we kind of consider what we do, you know, we call it electric folk music because it makes it a little more mysterious sounding, but it's, you know, accessible, interactive music for the people, whether they're 3 or 90.
Yeah, folk music seems to connote, at least to me, this idea of music sort of being passed around, you know, handed from person to person, as opposed to, you know, I listen to a lot of rock, but a lot of it is like, you know, it's being presented to you and you're receiving the rock, right? But it's not like, I'm going to go play that rock song for someone else. It's, you know, or sing it for someone else. It's like, oh, that was really great and cool. But it's more of a, maybe more of a one-way sort of relationship. I don't know. I'm just thinking about this as we're talking about it.
It absolutely is. And it's, there's, you know, I love rock too. And I love the idea of being entertained. You know, I love going to see a show where I just sit back and I can take it in. That's definitely not what we do. Is, you know, we're not doing a performance as much as we're doing something where the audience is a part of it too. And, you know, and that's, again, it's not a new concept. I remember when I was a kid in New Hampshire and my mother said, we're all going to get in the car and we're going to go to Boston and we're going to hear Pete Seeger and we're all going to sing. And it was the weirdest thing because we never sang at home, you know, but we're going to drive all the way to Boston and hear Pete Seeger play the banjo and we're all going to sing, you know. So that's what we're working off of, is when we think about our songs, we're thinking about, okay, what's the interactive piece here? You know, whether it's movement, is it just going to be a straight ahead dance song, or is it going to be a song where we can teach, it's got a 4-line chorus and we can teach it to the audience. So we're always thinking about that. So it's social music. It's social music, less of a performance.
How important is being able to dance or move your body to this music?
It's important. I mean, I actually thought the Pete Seeger model was it, where, you know, the musicians on stage, the audience is in their seats and they sing along. And I realized early on when I started doing family music, it was one time, man, I remember it like it was yesterday. So I was with my, you know, with my, the early incarnation of my band playing at the Kane Street Synagogue in Brooklyn, New York. And we, you know, everybody's sitting, they're singing along, they're doing their thing. And we played the Rock Island Line. And as soon as we started playing it, you know, the Lead Belly song, as soon as we started playing it, kids jumped out of their seats and they ran down to the front and they started dancing. And I realized, that's the other piece. And it was kind of weird that I hadn't thought of it earlier, because I was in a rock band, man. It wasn't even a gig if people didn't dance for us, you know. It didn't even count. And so as soon as I saw that, I was like, okay. So then we just started, we came up with a template. The last 3 songs are going to be pure dance party. And that was when Father Goose joined the band.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, that was his spot. So it's like, we're going to get everybody to that point. And Father Goose hits the stage and it takes everything up a notch. And
was he doing hokey pokey at the end of those shows? Because his hokey pokey is pretty definitive hokey pokey.
It was the best. Yeah, that was definitely one of them.
So and you would drive down to Boston from New Hampshire. You grew up in New Hampshire. How far away was that?
I think about 70 miles.
Okay. So like not like right at the Massachusetts border or anything.
No.
And what was your family like in terms of music? Like, did you grow up hearing more folk music than rock music? You know, were you discovering one and hearing the other from your parents? Like, how did that work?
Yeah, man. You know, it's funny. I've been giving it a lot of thought lately. My mom passed away in May, and so especially my brother and I, because you know we talk a lot, and my brother's, he's a musician. He's
Warren. An incredible
writer. He's the famous one in the family, and which is awesome.
You're both famous, but you know some of your crowds are some. There's a Venn diagram between the two of you. I know you both. I've read his Tom Petty book. I've heard your music. So vice versa and all that. So
yeah, but we we grew up. Our mom was a bohemian, and she was from the time I was six. And my brother was two. She was a single, and my sister was four. There are three of us, and my mom was a single parent for a lot of the years that followed that. She got divorced. We moved from Canada down to New Hampshire, and she liked folk music, but she basically let us play whatever we wanted to play. And we had library cards, and we would go to the library and check out records. And, you know, I think the thing about my mother that was so beautiful was that she recognized what it was we all liked to do. My sister liked to paint. I liked to play music. My brother liked music. And she created the conditions so we could go as far as we wanted with that. So if the conditions included going to the thrift shop to get records sometimes, or going to the library to get records, you know, playing music whenever we wanted, night or day, going to see people if they came through Concord, you know, stuff like that. She helped us to get exposed to what was out there. She wasn't especially musical in herself, although she loves opera, but you know, she created the conditions.
Yeah. I'm sorry you lost her in May, by the way. That's rough.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, man. It's, you know, it's, she had a very, very blessed life, she had, you know, dementia, and it hit real hard and for 2 years. And in God's plan, I think it was maybe, we lost our mom, but she was struggling with dementia. It was very hard for her after this rich life that she lived. But it did. But we had a great mother, you know. And so her spirit lives on. And we just had a memorial for her this last weekend. And she always made it clear she wanted, you know, when I go, I want you to put the fun back in funeral, and you know, it's got to be music. And so we did, you know. And I think we gave her a fitting tribute, and it was certainly a chance to reflect and a chance to really feel very, very grateful
for
someone who cared enough to help us be whatever we wanted, regardless of what she wanted us to be. She knew that we were going to follow a path, so she helped clear it.
Yeah, I lost my mom years ago, and it's nice when you can sort of get past the immediate memories of, you know, the sad stuff at the end, and just reflect on just all the amazing stuff that came earlier when they were, you know, more vibrant and healthy and just had such a huge influence on you. So, you know, the happy stuff, you know, comes to the fore more as time goes on, but you got to process all that. So.
Yeah, man, that's so true. And cause it really does burn up, you know, like a lot of stuff gets from the last years and months get burned into the brain, I think. But the gift, you know, another gift of that for Claudia and for myself is because we're not just playing for families. You know, here in Baltimore, we'll go to the women's prison, we'll go to the men's shelter, we'll go to play for families who have kids on the autism spectrum. We play for a queer Lutheran congregation and a congregation of unhoused people. So what we got really more keyed into was just how many old folks there are who find tremendous joy and comfort in music, and how underserved that community is, you know. And so this is the thing we're thinking about now, man, which I think is I don't want to say I think it's the future of family music, but let me just say, I think we can be doing more of this, and it would be tremendous in our communities. we had the, you know, we started to realize there's, you know, there's three things that old folks really respond positively to: music, animals, and kids. We can provide two out of three at our concerts. And as we're learning that, we're seeing that, we went out to UCLA and played at the Nimoy Theater, and they brought in a group of older folks. And the, you know, the old folks sat together, they're at the show, they're hearing the music, they're enjoying the kids. It's like, this is what we got to be asking presenters about every time. Can we, you know, how can we integrate some of the older folks into the experience of these shows? Because that's, you know, it's these are all hands on deck times that we're living in, you know, and,
right.
And how we don't have to do a separate show for them. They could just come to the one we're doing.
Well, that's why it's family music. But family in this case, you know, goes from being a little baby to, you know, as old as you can be, you know, like, I mean, you can't get a greater range of audience than that.
Yeah, man. No, the intergenerational piece is really, I think, it, you know, I think we don't give it enough credit, but it's, we got a plan, man. We got a plan.
Well, it's like you have a tribute to Ella Jenkins on the new album. And I mean, I remember growing up and hearing, you know, Ella Jenkins, like, was the first things in like elementary school as we'd hear Ella Jenkins. And, you know, now I'm a, you know, middle-aged dude and, you know, it's, and, but that sort of, that brought me back to that, but I also appreciate hearing it, you know, as old as I am now. So, you know, it's like the threads sort of don't go away, you know, like this, none of that music has an expiration date. Like, oh, I really outgrew that. You know, yeah. There are some things that you outgrow, but I don't think this kind of music is one of them.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And one of the things that we're seeing more now that's, I didn't expect, but it's incredible, is people in their late teens and early 20s that listened to my music back, you know, way back when, coming back around for just like a minute of like to revisit. And I don't know if it's nostalgia as much as it is, you kind of know what you're going to get, you know that there's going to be an experience, and maybe there's, I think it's a way of connecting to childhood, you know, and it's important that we, you know, I think it's more important that we connect to our childhood and stay in touch with that aspect of ourselves. Maybe it's more important than I realized before, but, you know, I think young, you know, these, you know, teenagers and kids in their early 20s, they know that they'll be welcomed, you know,
right.
It's not like it's just babies running around. It's, they know they'll be welcomed and celebrated in the space.
Sure. When you were a kid and you got your first guitar or started playing guitar, like how old were you and what were you, you know, trying to do at that point, or what were you playing?
I was 8 and I was a friend of my mom's. My mom had an airline guitar that she was going to learn to play and she never did. So she gave it to me, and a neighbor showed me some chords and Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. You know, I was getting these folk records out of the library, and so I was trying to play the folk songs, you know, the easier three chord songs. Discovered, you know, people like Tom Rush, who is real big in New England. I mean, he's big everywhere, but he was especially big in New England because that's where he is from. And Gordon Bach, of course. But then, you know, there was an oldies radio station out of Boston, man, WROR, the Golden Great 98. And they had, like, Wolfman Jack was coming back, Arnie Woo Woo Ginsburg, like the old, you know, because this was the 70s. And there was that American Graffiti. There was that whole kind of revival Greece. You know, the 50s music was coming back around again. And so the Golden Great 98, they're playing this stuff, you know, they're playing, you know, the Spaniels, and they're playing early Beach Boys, and they're playing, you know, Buddy Holly, Chuck Berry, they're playing
right.
All this stuff. And, you know, that to me was folk music too, you know, and it's three chords, you know, a lot of, not the doo-wop stuff so much, but it sounded like it was attainable music. So it felt like just another branch of the same tree for sure. You know, the connection between Woody Guthrie and Bo Diddley, it didn't seem like it was too, you know, not too many dots to connect.
It's funny when you think about the whole oldies thing from the 70s, like American Graffiti came out in 73 and the tagline was, "Where were you in 62? That was 11 years earlier. I mean, can you imagine now having a movie coming out nostalgic for like 2013?
Right.
Where were you in 2013? Yeah, Taylor Swift and Katy Perry had albums out. You know, it's like, what? Like, what's the difference? But back then it was like, you know, oh, it's like, and when you're a kid, which I was as well, it seems like this whole other era. And then you get older and you're like, that wasn't that long ago at that point. But it's kind of funny. Do you remember the first album you bought with your own money?
Yeah, it was Teaser and the Firecat.
Oh, yeah.
Cat Stevens. So it was a pretty solid choice. Yeah, and I mean, I haven't gone back to it recently, but I'm sure I would be pretty happy with it. He was great.
So at what point did you sort of make the transition from the kind of this, you know, folk stuff that you were taking out of the library and learning on the guitar to thinking more of like rockdom, you know, and you know, just being a rocker?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was just listening to the oldies and then when I was in high school, punk rock and new wave. And that was, listening, the Ramones, I love the Cramps and those kind of, you know, I mean, the Cramps was a pretty easy to connect the Cramps to the music that I was listening to on the oldies radio. And it just felt like, that was the music, you know, if you're 16, you're trying to think of some way that you're going to be able to operate socially. And if you could play electric guitar, that's going to, you know, at that point in time, that seemed like that was the ticket to ride. So I went to college. I went to Oberlin for a year with the specific idea that I was going to go there to start a band. I couldn't find anybody in New Hampshire that was... I felt like they were on my wavelength. And so I went to college and I met Tom Lloyd. And, you know, I met him the first day of school in the line for breakfast. So it was the first meal of the first day.
Wow. Bait.
Yeah. Yeah. And we, you know, we ate breakfast, went up to my room, said, "Yeah, man, let's start a band." And that was that. And I played with Tom for the next 10 years. That was, you know, the Del Fuegos started that morning. So we could have dropped out after 2 weeks because we had all the information we needed as far as, you know, here we go, let's do this. But we stayed for the year, learned a lot. Glad we did. And, told my mom we were going to drop out and we started a band. We're going to drop out and move to Boston. She said, "All right, you know, if that's what you think is you got to do, then go for it."
So where in Boston were you guys?
Alston.
Okay. Alston. Yeah, yes. Right along Commonwealth Avenue and the river and all that.
Affordable. Yeah. We went to the South End. I mean, I'd never heard the word gentrification or anything. I didn't understand the process and the racial underpinnings to all of that. I just knew that that's where we could afford to be. I have a little bit of compassion for the folks, you know, when things were starting to, you know, in Brooklyn, when Brooklyn began to get gentrified at a really rapid pace, a lot of times it was easy to, you know, look to the kids from Ohio that are moving in and, you know, moving to black neighborhoods and, you know, participating in the process of gentrification and racial displacement. But, you know, we don't always understand the bigger picture. And I certainly didn't understand that. But I also was very, very ill-equipped as a white dude from New Hampshire. I was very ill-equipped to navigate that. My racial conditioning was so deep that if I was in settings where people didn't look like me, I was just super uncomfortable. So I had no ability to be a good neighbor, you know, with my black neighbors and get to know people or anything like that. I didn't have any of those tools at that point.
Yeah, and Boston's a pretty weird city racially already. I mean, just coming into it, it's very sort of factional, and I don't know if that's the right word, but there's a lot of separation in Boston among people who live close to each other.
Absolutely, man.
At least there was at the time. So
yeah, and I moved there in 1981, and this was not that, you know, the whole everything popping off around busing. It hadn't been that, you know, it was only like 5 or 6 years before that that people were losing their damn minds, you know. And so it was, you know, it was a tense thing to step into. And like I said, I had no understanding of it at all. And didn't for a number of years. But
so at what point did your little brother, who's 4 years younger than you, start making music with you? Because at that age, you know, that 4 years is a bigger difference than it is at the age, you know, we're all at now.
I can tell you exactly when it happened. It happened the day he graduated from high school. And so the Del Fuegos were playing in Boston as a trio, and my brother would come down to Boston on weekends. And it was like, he was just such a fun guy to be around, you know? I mean, I have an image of opening for a group called The Liars,
I saw The Liars a bunch of times. Jeff Connolly and...
Yep. So we're playing with I can't remember the name of the shithole we were in, but we're at playing with the Liars, and someone had just spilled beer in the middle of the room. And I see my brother running from the back of the room, and he just slides from the middle of the room all the way to the front of the stage on this stream of beer. And I'm just thinking, he would be perfect for our band. It had nothing to do with whether or not he could play. It's like, you know, we just think you'd really fit in.
Now, would you would you guys sing together when you were growing up?
No.
He was too little, right?
Well, I mean, probably in my mind he was, but you know.
Yeah, I'm not saying yeah, from his perspective he was, but again, those 4 years when you're a teenager or whatever, it just feels more.
Yeah, for sure. But we're listening to the same music, and you know, we're definitely drinking from the same well as far as all that. And he was absolutely the right person for the job, and you know, probably understood showbiz better than all of us put together. So you know, he learned. I mean, we weren't great either, so it wasn't, the learning curve wasn't very big.
But so what were you aiming for at that point? Like, what was your sort of dream of where the Del Fuegos would go?
Well, this is the funny thing when I look back on it, you know, like the confidence of youth was in my mind, of course we're going to do well. You know, of course this is all going to work out. No plan B, no nothing, you know. But what we were doing, you know, was we were singing in our own accent. You know, there was at that point, in Boston, this is what it felt like. I don't know what it was like, but it felt like all these kids from the suburbs were singing in English accents. They're listening to the Jam, they're listening to the Clash, they're listening to these, you know, Undertones and all these groups, and then they're starting to sing in English accents. We're like, come on, man, you know, we're down there, we're doing Drifter songs, you know, we're singing Elvis songs and Chuck Berry songs. I mean, we were friends with all these people, so, you know, don't get me wrong, it wasn't like we weren't looking down on anybody. We just couldn't relate to it. We couldn't relate to it. You know, as much as we appreciated the Clash, we couldn't. We just thought we're doing American music, you know, and,
right,
and American music is so rich and there's so much to it. But we thought we were an R&B band, which was hysterical because we couldn't even tune our instruments, you know. But it was, you know, the spirit of punk rock and the do it yourself, but with this love of American, you know, roots music. So when we heard the Blasters, we lost our minds. It was like, this group is doing American music. We love this, you know, all of a sudden. And then X is, they're playing American music. And, you know, it wasn't that we didn't appreciate other music. It's just we thought, well, we're American, so this is what we love. This is what we grew up doing. We're going to, you know, we'll do our version of it. And this is certainly a vehicle for us to express ourselves. We don't have to go anywhere else for the good stuff. It's all right here. So, you know, Los Lobos and then Dream Syndicate, you know, all these groups started coming around, and they were groups that all happened to be on Slash Records. And we would open for these folks when they would come around, and they were all, you know, they all, you know, they were very, very cool with us. And our manager, Lily Dennison, at the time was friends with all these groups and, you know, understood the importance of connections and relationships. And so we started trying to, you know, we started sending tapes to Slash Records because if we couldn't be on Slash, we really weren't too interested. You know, we just thought this has got to be our home. And eventually it was.
So you guys got on Slash because you already loved all those bands that were on Slash and you're like, we want to be in that club.
Yeah, it was the identity of the label. And I mean, the other label was Ace of Hearts, and we started, we actually ended up, you know, and that was the Neats, and it was Mission of Burma, and it was, you know, some pretty incredible group, Nervous Eaters, incredible Boston bands.
Were the Liars on Ace of Hearts too?
Yeah, the Liars.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And eventually the Real Kids, you know, so it's like, the greatest of the groups. But we started making a record for Ace of Hearts, and then Slash said, hey, guess what, we changed our minds, we do want you after all, you know. And so we you know, with Rick Hart's blessing, we got out of that and went to Hollywood and started making records with Mitchell Froom for Slash Records, which is what we had always wanted. And it turned out to be a great, you know, great home for us.
Do you remember the first song that you wrote?
No. But no, no.
So either you don't remember it or you just remember it and you're like, I'm not talking about that song.
Yeah, it's option number two.
I could tell. That was like an evasive, you know, I don't remember that terrible song. What was the first song you wrote that you're like proud of?
Oh man, it would have been a ballad for sure. You know, I think, Have You Forgotten? Have You Forgotten? It made its way onto our, cause we felt like no matter, you know, like I said, way back earlier in our chat, we felt like if people didn't dance, it wasn't a show. So, you know, people knew that it was always a dance party, but part of the dance party for us was always that there had to be a slow dance or two or three.
Right.
You know, so we were, and those to us felt like the most fun songs to play, you know. And it, for a while there, we were doing If You Don't Know Me By Now, the Harold Melvin
right
song. You know, so we like to do the slow songs, but Have You Forgotten is a kind of a slow, more had more of a country feel to it. But, yeah, you know, still holds, you know, holds up in my mind, I think, that one.
Did you like recording Longest Day and Boston Mass, those first two records?
Man, I had never seen palm trees before. Are you kidding? It was unbelievable. You know, we all got in a van. We drove out to make, driving, you know, leaving Boston to go to Hollywood to make a record. It was unbelievable. And we got to, and we just said, we're going to just take turns driving, and we're going to go straight on through. And by the time we got to Ohio, it was about 6 a.m. It had been raining. The rain froze. The van went off the road and was totaled. We figured out how to get another van, pack up all our stuff. I mean, I remember it clearly because the sun was coming up. We're in the grassy median between the, you know, eastbound and westbound roads. We're in the grassy median, the van's on its side, we're all looking for each other, the sun's coming up, and then all on the, you know, the frosty grass, you can see all our 45s. We brought a whole milk crate full of 45s to listen to while we're out there, and they're just scattered everywhere.
Oh man. And
we're just calling out like, Woody, Tom, you know, like making sure that we're all, you know, made it out of the van. And and then we, you know, took a couple of days, we regrouped. People were incredibly cool and helpful to us back in Boston. They had a fundraiser for us, you know, like people were just so, we had, I mean, that's the thing, man, you know, it just seems like so often in life we don't know how much we're loved, you know, we don't know how much we're loved, how much we're appreciated. And I look back on it and I think Boston, people in Boston, They loved us in some, you know, I don't mean loved us like fan love, but they loved us as fellow artists and friends, and they loved us and supported us and took care of us. You know, I mean, that's, none of us can, we couldn't have done anything on our own. you know, like the Four Mil Fuegos. We couldn't have done anything. We wouldn't have made it to gig number one on our own. But it was the love and support of the music community in Boston that made everything possible for us.
Boston isn't being a Boston band wasn't a geographical thing. It's something beyond that because it really shaped who you guys were, right?
Absolutely. I mean, considering there's more colleges and universities than any city in the world, there's all this radio, and then there's all this new music coming out, and there's not too much of a roadmap for it. So there's all these free form, you know, there's a history already of free form FM radio in Boston, and now there's all the little stations that can really go free form. And so at that point, if you could put out a single and it was okay, you knew it would get played. And if it was a little better than okay, it would get played a lot, you know. And then, you know, the word would spread. Boston audiences would support touring bands. You know, there were venues of all sizes. It was just like, talk about creating conditions. Boston was, everything was just right at that time.
So what was it like to go to LA, record these albums, and then come back to Boston, one of which is named Boston, Mass? And, you know, I mean, did you feel like you were sort of the return to the conquering heroes kind of thing?
Yeah, we were ego tripping. I mean, I'll speak for myself. I was, you know, at that point, it had been suggested to us by Rick Hart, the guy who ran Ace of Hearts Records. He said, you know, don't make the mistake of thinking that if you're big in New England, that you've got it made. He said, you have to think nationally. And so we're getting in that headspace. And so we just wanted to tour. We just wanted to tour. And we were able to. So that was really, then we'd come back, you know, and we'd have these fancy boots that we bought at a truck stop in Oklahoma, or, you know, like all this stuff, like, yeah, look what I got. And, you know, it's like all of a sudden we're, you know, wearing different clothes and, you know, all that stuff, ridiculous, you know, posturing. But people still love, you know, people were still cool with us though.
Were you happy with the label experience?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it was a great experience for us. I mean, we knew going into it that it wasn't a deal that was going to make us millions of dollars. We really wanted to get out and be able to make a record and play, because at that point, you know, it was much more of a climate where you know bands, I don't want to say needed a label, but it really did help to be on a label at that point. So for us, just the association with Slash was a big deal. So it's like, you know, like, hey, we're label mates with the Violent Femmes now. We're going to, you know, it just elevated us. It elevated us in a way that was great. And, you know, we became a national band, and that was, you know, it was exciting. I mean, 22 years old, touring the country, starting to get to Europe and all that stuff, you know, it's incredibly, incredibly exciting.
Yeah. And the label mates you're talking about, like the Blasters, Los Lobos, I mean, these were not, you know, singles bands at that point, if you don't count La Bamba at least, but they were, you know, they were bands that sort of grew, you know, audiences from album to album. And, you know, it was more like people went to see, you know, Los Lobos or the Blasters because they loved that band, not because it was like, oh, I need to hear that one song.
Yeah, absolutely. There was groups that I feel like every group on that label represented something. You knew, and some of it was geographic, some of it was sort of spiritual, or just like what they, you knew what their touch points were for their music, and what they, you know, everybody was about something, and you knew what it was, and you could go and be a part of that. And it was, you know, It was an experience, and the energy around it all was just incredibly high.
Right. And Boston, Mass came out in 85, which is really sort of the beginning of the MTV era where everyone's making videos and stuff like that. Like, what was that like to sort of step into the whole video era?
I mean, for us, we saw the Violent Femmes put out a video, and all of a sudden they were all anyone cared about, and we thought it was because they had made a video that's why people love them so much. We didn't realize people love them because they're an awesome band. You know? We thought it was because they made a video. So we couldn't understand why when we made a video, we weren't immediately elevated to the same place as the Violent Femmes. However, we had a slightly different path at that point, because when we're we had had a lot of very positive press along the way. And so we're making Boston, Mass, and, making our second record. We're in the studio, and we're watching Live Aid. And at that point, we needed new amps. We still needed some gear. We needed some stuff. And so when Miller Beer came to us, we thought, rockers have been doing this kind of thing all along. It's no big deal for us. We'll do a beer commercial. We're practically selling it just by the way we live anyway. We didn't think there was going to be any blowback at all. So we did a Miller Beer commercial, and we're in the studio making Boston, Mass. During breaks, we're watching Live Aid. And so we're watching Live Aid, and all of a sudden they go to a commercial break, and there's our commercial. So all the other musicians are out there participating in this, huge charitable event, except for the Del Fuegos. They're selling beer in between acts. And it was like everything changed in the course of a day for us, in a couple ways. The critics immediately left. That was the end of our good press. But a lot of people got turned on to us too, especially in the Midwest, where people are less likely to see all that as a negative. They just saw, that looks like a rock band I might appreciate, So we were grateful for that. In a way, that had a bigger impact on us than any video we made. But that's the kind of thing that people now would be, pretty stoked about. It's like,
it's funny how much time has changed. Cause like back then there was this kind of purist, like, the Del Fuegos and Long Riders, are they selling out? What's going on? It's the end of the world. And now it's like, everyone does commercials and nobody discusses it at all. And like, anytime, if you can get someone to give you money to play your music and get exposure for it, like, people do it without even batting an eye. And you were in a different era at that time.
Totally different. Some of the older cats were, came to our defense. I remember specifically just being, it was more the guys our own age that were cutting on us a little more. But someone like Tom Petty, he did an interview, and all of a sudden it's a topic too. Like, would you ever do this? Would you ever do a commercial? And Tom Petty is saying, like, I don't think I'd do a commercial. I don't need to do a commercial, but I understand why the Del Fuegos would do a commercial. They still got to get amps,
Right.
So he could, he totally he had a bigger picture view of the whole thing. He'd been around rock a little more back when Otis Redding was doing a Coca-Cola commercial for the radio or something.
For the Who?
Yeah. And Elvis, the Stones, to us, we knew our history, so it wasn't a weird thing, but
so that totally surprised you, that backlash.
Yeah, it hurt. It hurt because a lot of our peers were the ones who were saying, doing interviews saying, I would never do that. And like, these are guys that we would, party with when we were out touring. But I also get it too, because I think, when you're young, sometimes there's that feeling like, I got to weigh in on every damn thing, and I also am going to, got to use situations to make myself look better. It turns out everybody's kind of insecure, and so I get that too. So I don't, it hurt at the time, but now I understand.
Do you think that had a lasting impact on the Del Fuegos, like in terms of your whole trajectory?
Absolutely. Absolutely, it did. But I think in the scheme of things, it was best that the book started to close at that point. You know, we had a good year of touring, but you know, drugs and alcohol. I'll speak for myself. Drugs and alcohol started to take precedence over writing good songs. You know, so we showed up for our third record. We didn't have a whole lot of good songs. Mitchell Froom did a lot to help us shape what we did have and to, you know, try and make something. But there wasn't an emotional core there. And so I think at this point, you know, I'm grateful that we didn't sell any more tickets than we did. Grateful we didn't sell any more records than we did. Grateful I didn't make any more money than I did, because I could have used any of that to kill myself. And, you know, so I'm just so, you know, I'm alive today. So that's the blessing. And I got another chapter, you know.
There you go.
Better.
Absolutely. Longer, better, bigger. How did you get through that period? You know, the self-destructive stuff.
Well, I mean, I got through it by finding a community of people that had been down the road before that were, you know, turning their lives around. So that's how I did it. And because I couldn't do it on my own, you know, the drugs and alcohol were too much for me to go up against on my own. So I looked around and found other people who had dealt with the same situation. And that's what worked for me. I think there's a lot of options for people, but I couldn't do it. I couldn't make that change on my own, for sure.
Right. How long ago was that?
34 years? Yeah, 34 years. So 34 years without broken furniture and, you know, like the tears and the, you know, all everything that comes with it, you know. And so I'm grateful every day, you know, grateful every day that you know, to be alive and I'm just so grateful for the Del Fuego's experience, because I could have lived the same way and been with a different group of people and killed myself easily. But, you know, I mean, there's just a lot of love, you know, as screwed up as we were at that time, there was a lot of love amongst us, and there were, like I said before, a lot of people looking out for us. And you know, I'm just so grateful for that. And I think that's, you know, that to me is sort of a life lesson, is that I was raised with a spirit of independence, but I was able to live because of a spirit of interdependence. And that's, you know, when I look back at it, that's the only reason that I was able to move out of that, and it's the only reason I was able to, you know, create something for the, you know, for the second act with Family Music, and be around for this third act with Claudia.
Right.
It's the interdependence and the love and support of people.
Caro Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's great beers include the classic Antihero IPA and the premium lager Cold Time. In these dog days of summer, you need to cool off with Cold Time. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's available in 12 packs of 12-ounce cans, and you know, they look pretty cool. And you did one solo record that's like the only record, again, that doesn't have like you with other people, just the Dan Zane's Cool Down Time from 95. Mitchell Froom produced that one too. What was sort of that experience like? And was that sort of, did you sort of come through that and think, I don't want to do this, or there's just the one of those?
Yeah, I mean, it was a great experience to do it. And I was playing shows around New York with Mitchell and Jerry Murata as a little trio, which was so much fun. And writing songs that I felt were pretty solid. And, you know, I mean, I love Mitchell and his production style. So it was a real, it was incredible for me to be able to be with Mitchell again and feel like I was showing up with you know, with the goods this time. But thank God, nobody cared, you know. And I say that because at the same time, my daughter had been born, and I was starting to play, you know, get re, you know, re, re-engaged around folk music because I was so terrified that as a parent, like, what am I going to do, man? Am I going to just sit around and watch the kids? You know, am I just, and it sounded like, it didn't sound good to me. I thought, well, what if kids are around and I'm playing music? You know, I could play music and I could do that. So I started thinking about music you could play in your living room. And I remember, you know, like before it all clicked for me, I remember being at a dinner and someone said, oh, what kind of music are you making now? And I said, oh, I'm, you know, it's kind of, you know, it's like rock and roll music. And she said, oh, can you play me something? I said, no, it's not that kind of music. I couldn't just play it for you. It's like, you know,
right.
As if it's so special that you couldn't possibly play it on an acoustic guitar. You know, like, what the hell am I doing? But I began to, that began to shift. And so, and I wanted my daughter to have the same experience with music that I had had as a kid, which is basically the folkways music, you know, and Lead Belly, Ella Jenkins, Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie, you know, like that music, which was the greatest all ages music. And so I went to the record store thinking, I'm going to find the updated version of the folkways stuff. And I went in, I remember being in Tower Records, I'm like, every damn thing in here is connected to a TV show or a movie. You know, it just seemed very commercial. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I couldn't find the other stuff I was looking for. And so I had an 8-track half inch reel to reel, and I just started recording songs with my friends. And Sheryl Crow lived around the corner, and she came in, you know, asked her to sing Polly Wally Doodle. She came in. Mitchell was married to Suzanne Vega at that time, so I asked if Suzanne would come and sing, and she wanted to do Erie Canal. So I was hanging out with a lot of West Indian women on the playground, and they were babysitters, and they were teaching me songs. So they recorded a song and came in. So that's what I did, and I made a cassette tape to give out, you know, waiting for my pop masterpiece to hit. I was giving out this cassette tape, and no one cared about my pop record. Everybody wanted more copies of this cassette. So I just said, you know what, I feel useful for the first time in my adult life. I don't have to ego trip on this stuff. I can have fun. I can do whatever the hell I want. You know, it's like creatively, this feels great. I could be a parent with this stuff. I could go to my daughter's preschool and play this stuff, you know? So everything felt like, it just felt right. You know, it felt right. And it felt right for the first time. And I realized, I'm not as locked into a specific type of music. I'm locked into using music as a way to be useful and to be a part of. You know, if I could be a part of and play music, that's unbelievable. And so I said, I'm through with pop music. I'm going to start a record company, and we're going to put out family music. That's what I'm doing now, because I think this is what I'm here to do.
No. I'm sure you've played for a lot more people doing your family music than you did the accumulation of your rock music, and probably sold a lot more records doing that too.
Oh, absolutely. Everything was more. And not that more is the goal, but it was just a longer, more fruitful, more creatively satisfying, has been. And I think, you know, the best is coming now, as Claudia and I are figuring out what's, you know, what we're able to do. And, you know, Claudia is such a gifted jazz vocalist, and her music therapy lens, you know, like, and we started playing with a guy that we met who just graduated from Howard as a jazz vocal major. So now it's a vocal trio form, which I love. Vocal trio music, you know, and always have, especially the Jamaican rock steady vocal trios are just my favorite, you know, it's like my favorite sound in the world. So we're playing as a trio now. And so it's just, you know, I mean, what a unbelievable gift that I can still.
No, it's great. Are you guys going to tour?
We're touring, you know, for us touring is always out and back, out and back, out and back. we're going to play in Long Island this weekend. We were just out in Palm Desert, but we actually are going on a tour. We're going to Finland in the middle of August. We're going on a 3-week tour in Finland, and so.
Was that like, let's go to Finland and we could do some shows? Or was it actually like, hey, Finland wants us to do shows?
It was Finland's call. Finland's on the phone.
Finland's on the phone. Honey, it's Finn. Finn? It's, Finland.
It's a party call. Estonia's on the phone too. And they so we're going to Finland and Estonia. And, that'll be really good. And I believe that. From my time with the Del Fuegos, just knowing how passionate listeners are in Scandinavia for American roots music, I believe there's an opportunity moving forward to go over more and to broaden, you know, how we do things in Europe. So I think that'll be exciting.
But you're not going to do like the big set of dates where you're in Chicago and Minneapolis and Detroit and St. Louis and Milwaukee and Madison or wherever.
It doesn't tend to happen that way because the family audiences really are weekend audiences. So
right, that's that makes sense.
But the thing that we are trying to do, and I think, is to take the model for what we do here in Baltimore and work with presenters to apply it to if we work with a presenter, a creative community-minded presenter in Chicago, there's a few things that we would be able to talk about. One is, can we make the show sensory friendly, you know, first off, so that we create conditions so that more people, including, you know, people on the autism spectrum, for example, but not exclusively, would feel comfortable in the space. There's, you know, in England, they call it relaxed programming. Here we generally call it sensory friendly, but it just means, loosening up the atmosphere, relaxing the atmosphere so more people feel like they can come as they are and be themselves, and families, making it a safe space for a neurodiverse audience.
Right. A wonderful chef that I know here, who is a very successful, restaurant, has been doing these sensory friendly events, like these dinners specifically for, communities where everything is kind of, toned down, smooth. I'm using the wrong terminology probably, but it's all about kind of having the good sensory experience while eating this delicious food, but creating a safe space around that, so everyone in the restaurant is, aware of, this is how we're doing this meal.
Yeah, man. No, it's, right before I met Claudia, I got exposed to sensory friendly, and it was immediate. This is like a wheelchair ramp. When you see the first time you see a wheelchair ramp, I think, of course,
right?
Of course we have this, and we should have it everywhere. And it doesn't mean that everyone's got to use the ramp. It just means it makes it easier for folks in a wheelchair. And the same is true with sensory friendly. It doesn't mean anything changes, but it means the doors open wide. I mean, things change, of course, but it doesn't mean anything fundamental changes. The music is the same, the experience is the same, but more people can show up as they are and enjoy it. And so I saw sensory friendly, what that means to have a sensory friendly concert. I'm like, this is the future. This is absolutely the future of family music. There is no downside anywhere in sight. We can all come together. And it means we're living in the real world. We're living in the real neurodiverse world. And we're acknowledging that, as opposed to the rigidity, like almost like a European rigidity of, you sit quietly in your seat, you're like, don't get up in the middle of the song and walk up and down the aisle. You sit and wait and then you clap at the end. It's like, no, we don't have to do that anymore. Some people need to walk up and down the aisle to have a full experience. And once we understand that, we can, we can be cool with that. And we can not only be cool with it, we can see ourselves in that too, because we are all wired in our own particular ways, and so it's just been great to
absolutely
But there's other stuff we can do too. And so for us, touring, you know, like meaningful touring would mean we would play the venue and we would have a sensory friendly show, but we would also be able to go and play at a prison, for example, or a shelter, or we would go where, you know, into an elder care situation, or go to a school, like these other kinds of things. People who won't be able to get to the show, how can we reach them while we're there? That's the ideal touring for us.
Absolutely. Wow. Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, and you know, it's a focus on music that isn't like, oh, we want to play the biggest venue possible and get the biggest rider and, you know, all of this stuff. Like it's really sort of getting back to the, you know, connection element of music, which is, you know, how can you connect with the most people in the deepest way?
Yeah. And these are challenging times for people. You know, these are challenging times and music is healing and music is uplifting. And sometimes it's just, you know, we can restore our spirits so that we can go out and, you know, face the next battle, whatever that may be. There's just a number of reasons why music is helpful now. And, you know, one of the experiences we're going to have in Finland, there's a town in which the church is the center point for the musicians in town. So the church coordinates all the musicians in town and sends work, you know, having an understanding of the community at large, you know, coordinates with the musicians and sends them out to people's homes where the older folks aren't able to get out and do their thing. So the musicians, regardless of what it is they want to be doing in their, you know, professional music life, whether or not they're professionals, but, you know, in their music life, part of what they do is they go out. And so it's like a service thing. And it's a model that I think works. And,
yeah.
And it's just thinking about, okay, we're musicians for a reason. We didn't get into this to make money. We got into this to make, to be meaningful in some way.
How often do you write songs, by the way?
I write more when it's time to, you know, to make a record, I think, but, you know, usually I'm putting down ideas, you know, fleshing them out. But Claudia and I are a good team now. So, but we're not writing every day.
But like it's like when you have sort of like, it's sort of more project oriented. Like when you have something to do, you'll sit down, as opposed to you're just, you know, on your bike and the song comes out of nowhere and you got to sing it into your voice memo or something like that.
Yeah. I think it's like the rhythm of it all is that we're kind of in a place now where we're just kind of feeding our heads. You know, we're listening to music in a different way and we're just thinking about music and we're grabbing inspiration in different places and just thinking about what the next step looks like. So I think that's part of that process. It's almost like before the songs get written, there's like some kind of shift that's taking place internally, and then that shift gets expressed in the next batch of songs. So they kind of come out in batches.
You ever write something that you're like afterwards, like, wait a minute, that's like kind of a kick-ass rock song. It doesn't really fit what I'm doing now, but that would have been like a Del Fuego smash or something.
There's sometimes, yeah, occasionally, but we're kind of lucky that we do have outlets for, you know, a lot of what we write that may not be, you know, even just going to working with some of these congregations, you know, we'll do a lot of writing for the congregations that we go to. I mean, we both love gospel music in its many forms. And so to be able to write gospel music is a, you know, incredible experience. So we do, you know, that's probably what we do most in an ongoing way.
Yeah. That song Sweet and Cool on the new album, that has a definite gospel feel going on.
Yeah, calling, you know, it's actually based on a gospel song.
Nice. Sounds one. Like it. Yeah, that one, My God, is a, you know, that's a spiritual. I didn't see any of the writing credits, so I don't know who wrote what, but awesome. Well, I really appreciate you talking to me about all this stuff, and it's pretty inspirational too, if I'm allowed to say that. The thing that you love about music is like when it connects with your heart, and you know, that's more meaningful than, you know, how much, you know, money people made off of it. Cause it's, you know, that's not what I listen to music for. So, it's very cool to hear what you're doing. And I've really enjoyed, you know, I enjoyed the Del Fuegos. And then, you know, again, when I had kids and I sort of discovered your family music, I was like, oh, I have this different way to get into this guy's music. And it's got such a good, vibe to it. And it's so positive that it just was really, it was just a fun thing to share, you know, with my, you know, with my daughters and my wife. So
I appreciate that. I told Claudia that I've been talking about her so much that it, just, it only made sense that she comes.
Hi. Mark,
hey, Claudia. Great to meet you. And you got a wonderful voice, and I really like those records. So thank you for
appreciate it. That means a lot. Thank you.
Where are you from originally?
I was born in New Hampshire. By way, my family came from Port-au-Prince, the capital of Haiti.
Oh, nice. But you were born in New Hampshire, so.
I was, yeah. So we were there for a number of years before relocating to California, where they now reside. And I've kind of traveled throughout. I lived in Boston and then New York when I met Dan. And now here we are in Maryland.
And have you gone back to Haiti much?
Not recently, not since, you know, there's just been so much upheaval. And
right.
No, I've not been in a number of years, but it is a special place, of course. It's home in many ways too. So I do miss the country. I miss my relatives out there that I don't get to see, of course. But it's been a while, maybe almost a decade since I've been back.
Mm.
Yeah.
So tell me about like making music with Dan, and just the kind of music you guys are making. Is that what you were sort of doing beforehand, or did you kind of come around on this family music thing?
I would say, I believe destiny was at work, you know. It really was a situation where I was living my life in Boston, Massachusetts. I am a board-certified music therapist, so I was running and directing programs out there in Massachusetts before meeting Dan. A good friend of mine introduced me to him. She wasn't trying to be matchmaker. It was really more of a musical connection that she could see flourishing between us. So we'd met, and from that point on, you know, I, of course, still lived in Boston, so I was still doing my work out there, but we started touring and started doing some local shows. Well, actually, our first date was in Chicago at the Old Town School of Folk, right? Yeah.
And absolutely. That would be a perfect place for you guys to play.
Yeah. That was our first show. It was sensory friendly. It was memorable. It was also our first date, so that was really special.
Wow. So first date in both senses of the word.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But I will say, you know, for me, making music with Dan just felt so, you know, the record is called Pieces of Home, but it felt like home in making music with Dan. It felt so natural. It felt very familiar, even though, you know, from the moment I met him, you know, I didn't know him, but I felt like I knew him so well after we had sat around the table for hours singing songs, because music is just such a powerful way of course, connecting and getting to know someone on such a deeper level than just conversation could ever do. So the music spoke and it soared, and I just felt so connected to him because we're both from New Hampshire. There's a lot to talk about.
Right.
Both New Hampshire and our musical backgrounds, different in many ways, but alike in many ways too. And from that point on, I mean, we've been making music from the very first day that we'd met, and it's never slowed down. I just feel like we're just falling deeper and deeper into our rhythm.
It's great.
A beautiful thing. Yeah.
Do you guys like, you know, have dinner and then pull out the guitars and just start singing along until you?
What do you mean? If we don't, the dinner's out while the guitar's out while we're having dinner.
Is that true?
Oh yeah. The guitar has a seat right around. Yeah. The guitar is out. It's rarely in the case, you know, you never know when inspiration will hit. But yeah, we do make music sometimes after dinner and before dinner, and it's just, yeah, music is always happening around here.
If you have like a dinner party, it turns into a hootenanny.
It's been known to happen. We've kind of started a tradition. We really wanted, you know, we have friends that come to visit, and we thought, what a gift to be able to have people in our home and to share a meal, but also to share a song together. We found that making that happen has like elevated the vibration too. Like the company leaves feeling like we had no idea this was gonna happen, but they really enjoy it. Even those who are not necessarily considered musical or whatnot, but I feel like it just allows us to get to connect on a deeper level. So we make music with our guests that come, whether or not they are musical. We pull out the guitar and we sing. That is something that we do with everyone that comes to visit.
You guys have inspired me because I go to this like camp every summer where it's like this family camp, and we'll sit around at night around the friendship fire, which is basically a campfire, and people will bring out their guitars, and I was like singing along with everyone, and I play guitar but pretty badly, but I'm really terrible at playing anything that anyone else knows. And I feel like, you know what, that's going to be my goal this year. I'm going to learn a few things that other people know. So, you know, because then we can all join in instead of just me playing something, you know, it's playing some obscure song that I made up or something. So,
yeah. And so I find that the energy shifts in such a beautiful way, because it's interesting, you know, people are comfortable in their skin. They're hanging out the whole time talking to, and then when a guitar comes out, sometimes there's a little bit of, wait, what's happening? What's going on? And then once, you know, we try to keep it as communal as possible. It's sing along. It's find your way in. It's non-threatening in any way.
Right.
But you see the release happen while they're, you can physically see that, like where they relax in the music, and then we're just having fun. And then after that, they're like, that's just the best thing. And the kids remember it. They're like, remember when we went to Dan and Claudia's house and we sang, you know, it's something that families talk about after they come over too. So it's really powerful.
Do you play an instrument?
I do. I play a couple. I do play flute. I play trombone. I play some guitar.
Nice.
Little bit of ukulele. I've been playing with the theremin.
Oh, you guys have a theremin?
We do have a theremin.
Oh.
Yeah, that's a fun one.
The theremin sing-alongs can be really great.
We haven't done that yet. Yeah. Maybe for our Halloween get-together, that'll be the instrument we pull out.
Right. Yeah, when you do your like a 50s B-movie soundtrack.
You can do
that. Nice.
There you go.
Well, yeah. Wonderful meeting you. Thank you so much.
Nice to meet you too.
You know, hope to see you guys come back to the Old Town School of Folk Music. That's an easy one. Great meeting you guys. And you know, good luck with the album release and all that.
All right.
Thanks, Mark. Well,
thank
great
you so
to meet
much.
You.
It was really great talking with you.
All right. Thanks. You too. All right. See you later.
Right. Bye. Bye.
That's all for episode 144 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Dan Zanes and to Claudia for offering such an inspirational story about the power of music to anyone of any age. Be sure to pick up Dan and Claudia Zanes' new album, Pieces of Home, when it comes out August 30th on the Smithsonian Folkways label. Go to danandclaudia.com to learn more about them and their music and what's coming up. You can also buy the Dan and Claudia and Dan Zanes and Friends albums at danzanes.bandcamp.com. Follow Dan Zanes and Dan and Claudia Zanes on Instagram as well. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Wake, who never runs wild. For a mere $24, you can become a Carol Pop friend and help keep this thing going. Please contribute at carolpop.com. Your support is much appreciated. I'm Mark Carroll. Please follow Carol Pop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Carroll at MarkCarro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop Conversation. Thanks.